yourself up in the front after he's done with his comments, that would be great. All right, that being said.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to speak here, and it was humbling to read everyone's list of achievements followed by me, which is, it's just like, this guy has a podcast, I guess. So I started podcasting a few years ago with a show called Counter Apologetics that was focused on like pop level Christian apologetics, which gradually led me to an interest in philosophy of religion and philosophy of mind. I started another podcast, Walden Pod, and started uploading on YouTube under my name. And across all platforms, we recently crossed our millionth download, which I mention to brag. No, not just that, because I don't know if everyone's aware that there's like an appetite in the public for philosophy and for your work. It's not that you're going to get millions of views or you're going to get rich off of the material, but there are people out there interested in philosophy. So I thought I'd mention that. So I'm supposed to be briefly responding to Joanna and Tim's talks, and just due to time, I can only focus on one or two points and kind of drill down on those. I guess I'll start with Joanna because that's more fresh in my mind. Before I knew what she was talking about, I thought she might be revamping her Why Panpsychists Should Be Christians paper, and then we could really have it out. but no, I love the God is a dominant monad idea. It reminded me of that passage, in him we live and move and have our being. If you take that really literally, you might end up as a panentheist. So there are, on like divine embodiment though, there are two points I wanted to raise just as, you know, potential questions that might set boundaries or something with like widespread Christian beliefs concerning freedom and the afterlife. So as Joanna has pointed out elsewhere, divine embodiment seems like it might intensify the problem of evil since there's sort of less of a division between God and the world and perhaps less autonomy. So, you know, there I'd be wondering about the relationship between independence and autonomy. So, you know, the most autonomy, I suppose, would be a situation where we're independent of God, where God kind of creates us and we're separate and we kind of go on our way. And in this kind of panentheist world where we're sort of in the mind of God in some sense or another, we're certainly less independent, even less than classical theists would suppose, as we're like being sustained every moment by God. Yeah, we're certainly less independent and perhaps less autonomous if we're in the mind of God, and that might sharpen the problem of evil quite a bit. The second question is mostly about the afterlife. Again, like widespread Christian beliefs about the afterlife, like sort of the moment that you're gone, the moment that you pass away, if you were to ask certain questions like, well, can they still feel things? Are they still having experiences? You know, can they hear you or hear prayers? Most would say, yes, they still exist. But in kind of a more monistic view, it seems like that might be problematic. You know, there's more of a reliance on a physical resurrection, which is obviously, you know, a part of Christianity. But nonetheless, there are these widespread beliefs about the afterlife that might come into conflict with a more monistic view, like panpsychism. So Ralph Stefan Weir, in his book on dualism, he challenges this belief that, you know, oh, more ancient systems, they're all more monistic. It wasn't until, you know, Descartes and evil Western dualism where everyone suddenly became, you know, non-monist. He found, you know, so he has this way of kind of arguing that dualism is more widespread than it's sometimes supposed, which has to do with the afterlife. Like, instead of interrogating their stated beliefs, it's more like, okay, what do you think about the afterlife? Like, when, like, what do you think about ancestor spirits? What do you think about, okay, this person has died, their body is there, are they there as well? Or can they still hear you? Are they still having experiences? And it's sort of in this way that he gets his dualist foot in the door and, you know, arguing that dualism is more widespread than it's often supposed. So I guess those are two questions I would have about, you know, panpsychism and panentheism. What bearing does that have on freedom? And what bearing does it have on the afterlife? Okay, so the general theme for this morning on the title, it said a loving universe versus an indifferent universe. So I guess I wanted to mention that I was an atheist for the better part of a decade from the time I was a teenager well into my 20s. And I guess I'm more of an agnostic now due to some of the non-standard forms of theism that, you know, for instance, Philip Goff has spoken about, finite theism, and Tim Mulgan as well, a non-standard form of theism where there's a omnipotent, omniscient, morally perfect God, but one who is sensitive to a kind of threshold of significance, and humans all fall below the threshold of significance. So that can kind of help with the problem of evil. So there are these kind of non-standard forms of theism, and there are these non-standard forms of naturalism or just non-theism that have just overall made me less confident one way or the other. For those 10 years or so, I was an atheist because I assented to the hypothesis of indifference, which is a view articulated by David Hume in the Dialogues, where he points to some conflicting data, what he calls the strange mixture of good and ill, which points to a blind nature. And he concludes, quote, "The original source of all things is entirely indifferent to all these principles and has no more regard to good above ill than to heat above cold or drought above moisture or to light above heavy." So in contrast to that, to the hypothesis of indifference, on which the universe or foundational reality has no sensitivity to value or disvalue, there is the value selection hypothesis. So I think the core of the atheism-theism debate is really between the value selection hypothesis and the hypothesis of indifference. And it's non-standard forms of both that kind of drove me to agnosticism, among other things. So the common forms of both are not exhaustive. So this would be like, you know, materialist atheism on the one hand, and then kind of unlimited omnitheism, you know, on the other. And, you know, those are not, theism is not the only form of the value selection hypothesis. You know, there's a very straightforward mechanism, as it were, where you have this person or persons who are sensitive to considerations of value and bring about the world. And that's how you end up with considerations about value and disvalue, sort of causing things to be the way they are, you know, causing laws and, you know, the nature of the world to be the way that it is. Whereas if you have, you know, the hypothesis of indifference, there's just no sensitivity. There's no, you know, constraint on value or disvalue. It's just indifferent to those things. So my point is just there are many forms of the value selection hypothesis. There are non-standard forms of theism, like I mentioned, which at least the thought is they offer the hope of accommodating arguments for theism and against theism, like the fine-tuning argument on the one hand and the problem of evil on the other. There are also non-theistic alternatives, you know, non-theistic versions of the value selection hypothesis that I'm more partial to, like axiarchism, natural teleology, and panagentialism. So that brings me to Tim Mulgan's talk. So there was, when I was reading it ahead of time, there was this idea that immediately grabbed me about the threshold of cosmic significance. So as I mentioned, so humans are objectively valuable on Tim's view, but they don't surpass this threshold where they're significant, where they affect the, you know, choice worthiness of this world. So not all objectively valuable creatures are going to pass a certain threshold of significance. He says, quote, "I distinguish significant creatures from valuable creatures. Valuable creatures have some degree of cosmic value. Significant creatures are valuable creatures whose value exceeds the threshold for relevance to divine choice worthiness. Significant creatures contribute to the choice worthiness of the worlds they inhabit. They're part of the reason why this exists. All significant creatures are valuable, but not all valuable creatures are significant. Some creatures are good in themselves, but not good enough to matter at all from the divine point of view. And perhaps we are among them." So even more startlingly in his book, "an otherwise identical human-free cosmos would have been just as good." So you might have caught some hints of this near the end of his talk, where things took this very dark turn, where it turns out we don't matter. So even though God is omnipotent, omniscient, and morally perfect, he's not motivated to prevent any of the suffering that's happened on Earth that you can call to mind. So, you know, this would obviously help with the problem of evil. But I take that to be kind of the main issue for the view. So I think the conjunction of two meta-ethical views would threaten the conceptual coherence of the cosmic threshold of significance, namely moral rationalism and reason's internalism. And, you know, by extent, the larger model of God at stake and its capacity for dealing with the problem of evil. So the first one, moral rationalism. Essentially, if moral reasons are or strictly imply reasons for action, and if motivation is necessarily generated in moral agents by reasons for action, then this idea of a threshold below which God is indifferent despite his moral perfection seems suspect. So Christopher Gregory Weaver wrote about this I came across this paper on the evil God challenge. He's trying to undermine the coherence of an evil God who's omniscient, omnipotent, and maximally malevolent. But I think it's relevant here. And I should note that Richard Swinburne has also argued that omnibenevolence flows from omniscience. You know, if you're familiar with this general strategy of, you know, trying to reduce or ground divine attributes and other divine attributes, which has, you know, certain theoretical advantages. But he says the idea of a rational agent who sees that something is good, you know, that refraining from bringing about something would be better than bringing it about, and yet he still brings it about, he says that's incoherent, the idea of a rational agent who does that. And I agree with Swinburne, but I think he assumes meta-ethical views that he doesn't identify, but Weaver does. So that's why I'm focusing on Weaver's paper on the evil God challenge. So anyway, back to the meta-ethical assumptions here. Moral rationalism. So roughly put, moral rationalism is the thesis that duties and or moral obligations either strictly imply practical reasons for action or are just identical to such reasons. So they imply practical reasons for action or they're identical to such reasons. This is actually a fairly common view. Kant maintained that moral obligations provide practical reasons for action. So one version of, this is something I first heard from Russ Schaefer Landau, one version of moral rationalism would say that an act is excessively cruel just is a reason to not do it. You know, so like that an act would involve breaking a promise or that something would be unjust just is a reason to not do it. So I think that moral rationalism plausibly entails that a moral agent who is not motivated to do what's morally obligatory in a given situation is being irrational, practically speaking. So in that case, you know, the balance of reasons would weigh in favor of one course of action, and they would know that, and they're not taking it because they're not motivated to take it. That would be irrational. So I think that, like I said, I think that follows from moral rationalism, but we could either defend that entailment, or we could independently defend reasons internalism, which says that moral agents, upon determining that an action is morally right or obligatory, will then be motivated to take that action. So reasons will stir motivations in a moral agent. Okay, so just to reiterate, it's moral rationalism and reasons internalism, I think, that are going to be a problem for this idea of like a threshold. So this is like a broadly anti-Humean view, as you may have thought to yourself. So Hume famously said that it's, strictly speaking, not irrational to prefer the destruction of the entire world to the scratching of your finger. So, you know, that is in stark contrast to what I've been describing. So if he were to say, oh, why should I prefer one to the other? I would point out that one of them involves the genocide of the entire human race and all life on Earth, and the other does not. And I guess he would say, oh, yeah, sure, but you haven't given me a reason for it yet. And I would think, no, I did just give you a reason for it with the, you know, genocide of the whole human race stuff. He also said explicitly that it's not irrational to go for the lesser good instead of the greater good. So you correctly identify two goods. One of them is the lesser good. One of them is the greater good. And yet you still go for the lesser good. He would say it's not irrational to be motivated to bring about the lesser good. So the line between these two meta-ethical views is a bit fuzzy, but the big picture is that this is a broadly anti-Humean view of moral reasons and motivations that I say throws a bit of a wrench in the threshold of significance. So if there are moral facts, and it is a moral fact that excessive, unnecessary human and animal suffering is bad, and that fact that it's bad provides reason to refrain from bringing it about, and moral agents will be motivated by these moral reasons, then the threshold of significance starts to look unsustainable to me. So good news, if I'm right, human suffering does actually matter. So as Weaver argues, this rules out an evil God, but I think it's also relevant to certain alternative models of God. So it's not that I'm, so wildly confident in these meta-ethical views, or I think they're uncontroversial, or no reasonable person could disagree with them, or something like that. I do accept them, but I think it's just worth flagging, like, okay, here are the boundaries, like, here are some costs to this theory. Like, if you accept this, then I think you're going to commit yourself to this broadly Humean view of moral reasons and, motivations. And maybe that's a reason to not accept it, because you'd have to believe that Hume was right about something. So, yeah, it's not that I think that it's a sure thing that these meta-ethical views are correct. I think it's just worth flagging, like, I think you're committing yourself maybe to rejecting certain meta-ethical views if you adopt this model of God. So I have more to say, but I think I am already over time. So I think I'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to give Joanna and Tim a little time to respond to some of the comments that to Emerson's comments, and then we'll move to the questions. Just so you know, the schedule is changing in real time, and it's constantly evolving. So we've moved up the food service. There's a lot of things happening. So just keep that in mind. Please be patient with us, because of course this was a pretty dramatic change in the preparing. So yeah. That being said.
Can I go to answer?
Yep.
Great.
Yep.
So thank you for your comments. It's always fun to have a, what about these two other massive questions that you're, you know, that tangent, that do relate, but I didn't address directly. But I am grateful for it, because I am, one of the reasons I wanted to write about embodiment is because I want to think about, I do want to think about death and the afterlife, because I want to think about panpsychism in relation to systematic theologies as a whole, if that makes sense. Well, once we've got some basic philosophy of the question off the ground, what about more particular things in Christianity, like sacraments and resurrection and all these other things? So that's, if you were interested, one of my long-term projects. So I'm grateful for these questions, and I've got thoughts about the afterlife. I've got fewer thoughts about free will. So regarding the afterlife, what happens for Leibniz when we die is a good place to start, right? So on his account of embodiment, monads never cease to exist. They could if God annihilated them. He does say God's got the power to create them and annihilate them, but otherwise, if God doesn't do that, they just go on forever. Because they're simple, because they cannot be divided, blah, blah, blah. So what happens when we die for Leibniz is that the dominant monad, stops having subordinate monads that make up this body, but I don't cease to exist. I'm still a perceiving monad. But my body disintegrates, so I stop dominating this particular configuration of subordinate monads. So, for Leibniz, we're just waiting until the resurrection, when I'll get a body again. Who knows what it looked like, but it'll be subordinating other monads in roughly this configuration. And in one sense, I'm not recognizably me in that interim period, right. But I'm still part of not just do I exist in an interim state, but I'm still part of this creation. I'm still a monad buzzing around this creation, as it were.
Right.
So that's what he would say. Now, if you think of, so if you disagree with Leibniz's view of embodiment, and you think that what I am as in a panpsychist world is a whole, is something that kind of is made up of my parts, other minds being the parts, and I emerge perhaps, or I am a combination. So if that's the view, then when my body disintegrates, because this is a functional system, when my body disintegrates, I die. I'm kind of annihilated, because I'm just like this emergent thing that's suspended in existence by the parts. So when the parts mm-hmm. aren't working, I'm not there anymore. And again, resurrection would be slightly more radical, bringing me back into existence, and I would have a gappy existence, and some people are okay with that and some people aren't. So I think they're basically the two models that a panpsychist would say about death, and then about the prospect of resurrection, and what happens in between.
Okay.
So it does depend on your view of, you know, what bodies are and whether or not they combine or not. Right, so
doesn't that seem to run afoul of, like, I don't know, not that this is like a big cost of the theory, but just of like widespread Christian beliefs about the afterlife and like what it's like and when it starts and all that?
No, I don't think so. But I think I've got a slightly broader view of what Christians believe about the afterlife. So I think Christians are committed to one thing about the afterlife, and that's resurrection. And they're not all committed to intermediate state, and not all committed. They have very different views of what death is. all sorts of views about the afterlife. Definitely disembodied heaven is not a Christian view, but it is the view that Christianity is portrayed as on The Simpsons, right? So, like, but it's so not a Christian view, but that's what everyone thinks Christians believe. So, like, Christians, the only thing Christians, are, I think, are committed to is a physical embodied afterlife at some point, now or long time in the future, depending on how you interpret Jesus' conversation with the thief on the cross. But that's it. Other than that, we disagree on a bunch of stuff. So I don't think a Christian, I don't think panpsychism is a cost for Christianity. In fact, I think it's a benefit, because I think panpsychism does have this closer relationship than most standard substance dualisms regarding mind and matter. And so it makes more sense on a panpsychist view that, like, you'd need a body in the afterlife. Because I think one of the big challenges for traditional dualist Christians is, like, why does God bother resurrecting a body? Like, you're fine without one.
Yeah.
So a panpsychist has a reason for that.
Right.
You need a body.
Right.
Or you are a body. Okay, and then on the free will point, as I said, I've got less views on this. I'll start off again, just because this is the nature of this today's paper, of what Leibniz thought. So Leibniz was a compatibilist about free will, I think. So what matters for your autonomy is that you are the source of your own actions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clear in the monads. They contain within them, and they are, in a sense, the source of everything that will happen in their existence. Not that they could do otherwise, because they couldn't really do otherwise. And I was debating with David yesterday whether or not God could even really do otherwise on Leibniz's view, and I wasn't 100% sure. But certainly for the monads, freedom consists in being the source of your own activity. So moral responsibility is conserved on that view, insofar as when you do something wrong, it's you did it, and you're the only one that can bear moral responsibility for that, because you're the source of your own actions, even though, strictly speaking, you couldn't do otherwise. So obviously that's just a big debate between libertarians and compatibilists.
Yeah.
But I do think it relates quite strongly, and this is why I wanted to go first, because I can hand over in a seamless manner, to Leibniz's view that this is the best of all possible worlds. So he gets obviously ridiculed for that by Voltaire. I mean, Candide, Voltaire's text Candide, which I haven't read since I was an undergrad, but from memory, basically, this character, Candide, goes around and lots of horrible stuff happens to them, and they're like, oh, it doesn't matter, the best of all possible worlds, really, it doesn't bother me that much. And it's just a satire. But that's not Leibniz's view of why this is the best of all possible worlds. It's not because suffering's not really that bad. It's because, very much like Tim's argument, in a sense, I was thinking throughout your paper, I think Leibniz and you should chat. Because Leibniz's reason that this is the best of all possible worlds is because it's a world full of life, a world full of minds on his account, mm-hmm. because he's not saying, like, he does think it's this world, but he's more arguing that this metaphysical system, of which he thinks happens to be true of this world, is the best possible world, because it's full of mind and life and creatures being the source of their own actions. And I think that relates to how he can defend a compatibilist view of freedom, so that's how I got there. But yeah, I don't know quite if that answered your question about the relationship between independence and autonomy, but...
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so it's on to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think you've definitely identified one of the things that is a problem for my broader view. One thing I would say is I talked about the threshold of cosmic significance a bit more in the paper and a lot more in my book than I did in the talk. And so one move I could make is I could just say, well, this exploration of this reimagining of Anselm and the thinking about this and that in terms of him is not for me meant to be wedded to the view that I defended in my book, right? And so in particular, the threshold of cosmic significance might do different might play different roles in different contexts, right? And so in the book, with the anthropocentric purposivist view, I want to hold on simultaneously to the idea that we're not part of the purpose of creation. We're not part of the reason why the universe exists. Our well-being is not something that matters to God or that God cares about. But I also want to hold on to the idea that the cosmic purpose can still be, in some sense, a source of objective values and motivations and reasons for us. And it's wanting to hold on to both of those that creates some of the problems. And so you could just say, well, look, there's a universe that there's a God or that or whatever that creates the universe, and it creates in response to these values that might just be unrelated to the values that we've mm-hmm. got, right? So that would be a problem for me in terms of some of my other commitments, right? But the other thing I would say is that yes, there are problems with having a threshold of cosmic significance and saying, well, this is the point at which this is the point that matters for creating universes, but there are lower levels of resemblance that might matter from different perspectives. On the other side of that, you've got the problem of evil, mm-hmm. right? And so, as with a lot of these debates, one of the things you have to do is weigh up the different costs that you're prepared to pay. And so the anthropocentric purpose of this view, part of that, and part of the idea of the principle of humility that I'm trying to explore is this idea that one way to respond to the problem of evil, or one thing we might regard as a lesson from looking at the world that we're in, is that if it's created by somebody, they're not somebody like us. If they're a moral agent at all, in the sense of being someone who responds to values, then they respond to values in different ways from the way that we would respond to values. And they're certainly prepared to accept possible worlds in which there's a lot of evil, right? And if you have a kind of pluriverse, if you think that lots of different possible worlds exist, then in a way you've got a worse problem of evil, because you think you're conceding that there are better possible worlds, and you're saying that they exist, but this one exists anyway, because for the mechanism or the person or the whatever it is that's creating things, plenitude is a higher good than suffering is a bad, at least in some sense. And so I think the response that I would want to give to arguments based on moral rationalism and reasons internalism and things is going to be to say, this is a model of God where God might be able to see that certain things would be moral reasons for beings like us, but God does not recognise those things as reasons for God, or at least for God they're overridden by other reasons. Mm-hmm. So you could either say the suffering doesn't matter at all, or you could say maybe the suffering matters a bit and it's a reason not to create a world, but there's other reasons which are greater reasons to create a world. And the way that those balance out and are calculated for God might just be very different from mm-hmm. the way that they're calculated for us.
Am I right about the bigger picture about part of the motivation for that approach is to try to sort of, okay, the problem of evil seems like a good argument. There are these arguments for theism that seem like good arguments. Maybe they can both work together and point towards this model that you're describing.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, that's a good... Okay. That's a good way of summing it up. Yeah, so you say, well, you know, some of the evidence points to there not being a god, but a lot of it points to there not being a god who cares about us in a particular kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And other evidence or other considerations, other arguments point to there being some kind of purpose. Right? And everybody has to square those two things somehow or other. And I suppose what I'm wanting to do is to keep as much as possible of the traditional theist arguments for there being a purpose and for there being a God and for there being an explanation of why the universe exists.
Mm-hmm.
I want to keep as much as possible of that while treating the argument from evil as a fairly decisive reason to think that there isn't a God who cares about us mm-hmm. in a particular
yeah.
kind of way. Yeah.
Okay, all right, let's move to questions from the audience. And so, okay, well, we'll start with Chris, and then go here, and then to John.
I've got a question for Joanna. This question may be out of scope, so if it is, I've got a second question to ask instead.
Okay.
Oh, if we could just stick to one, if you
yeah,
want.
Yeah, I'll stick to one. But I'm saying if you'd like to go, because she doesn't want to answer.
Okay, go ahead.
What should Spinoza have responded to the criticism you described at the end of your talk?
I'm so Team Leibniz, I really don't know.
I'll ask the second
one. You ask the second one, yeah.
Is Leibniz's idea that monads are points of view and have perception
yeah.
essential to his whole system? Or is it something that you could... Because it's a bit that most people have most difficulty with.
Yeah.
Could you kind of excise that and still have the hierarchy of monads and blah, blah, blah?
So, I'll think about that as well. They're essential for Leibniz because what's really essential is that they're simple substances that are the source of that contain within them everything that happens to them, and he just can't think of those as anything but minds. Minds are the only things that are like that. They're the only simple things. So they're the only real substances, and minds just are perceiving things. So if you could come up with something else that is simple, like a mind is simple, with no parts and no ability to be divided, that is also a source of action, that would work. But what that would be if it's not a mind, Leibniz can't imagine, and I can't either.
John?
Yes, a question for Tim. I'm just wondering whether you think that the assumption of human insignificance should include intellectual insignificance. If so, we might come to wonder about the whole project of metaphysical theorizing, or if we include the assumption in one of our metaphysical theories, we might thereby come to gain reason in doubt about whether the theory is correct. Yeah.
That's a good question. I mean, part of it is, you know, turn on what we mean by insignificance and insignificant relative to what, right? So I do want to say we should be open to the possibility that there are levels of understanding or intelligence or ability to theorize or whatever that are greater than ours and that might be cosmically significant in a way that our level of intelligence isn't, right? And so the thought there is somebody says the universe is really fine-tuned. It's fine-tuned to produce intelligent creatures who can really understand what the purpose of the universe is. And I want to say that could be true without us being those creatures. And that's at least a possibility. And we could have evidence that this... I mean, we couldn't discover evidence that that wasn't true, because we're never going to have explored enough of the universe to know that there aren't smarter beings. And we could have evidence that it was true, because we could bump into the smarter beings. But it's not clear to me that that puts us in any worse a position in terms of doing philosophy or doing physics or thinking about things than we were before, right? So we already know that we're quite good at thinking and that we're quite fallible at it, and that we could be a lot better. And we certainly know that it's logically possible that there could be beings who are much better at thinking and much better at figuring things out than we are. And so in a way, whether those beings actually exist or don't actually exist doesn't really change the epistemic position that we're in, I think, which is that we've got to make the best use of whatever intellectual faculties we've got while recognising that they're fallible.
So in a way we can enlarge the disjunction of epistemically possible metaphysical views. I'm attracted to your guiding principle of humility, and so I'm just wondering where that leads when you incorporate some of the results, thinking about humility in a theory.
I mean, it does mean, so in the particular context of the sort of questions I'm asking, it means being open to the idea that the perspective from which the universe has been created is one that we find very hard to understand, or very hard, or that may be very different from what we expect it to be. Which isn't, I mean, that's not a new idea in theism, I suppose. I mean, there's a more positive thing that goes back to this idea about the sort of humans being objectively valuable but cosmically insignificant, right? So if we thought we had reason to think that something like understanding or intelligence or consciousness was part of the purpose of the universe, then even if we think that we've got those things to a lesser degree than would be enough to justify creating the universe, we've still got them to some degree, right? And so you could think, oh, this gives us an extra reason to pursue our own feeble attempts to understand the cosmos, because even though they're pretty pathetic from the point of view of the universe, they're still... they're the best approximations that we can get of what's actually
happening. Thank you.
Sorry, in the interest of staying on track, we're going to have to not get to the next question that was in the queue. So with that being said, let's thank our speakers. We're going to take a 5-minute break and then go to the next...